Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in the richest nation in the world. And we spend more on healthcare than any other country. Twice as much, in fact. So why do we lag the world by a considerable margin in healthcare outcomes? The answer to that question is complicated and involves getting the answers to many other questions. For the past several months, WFAE News has been reporting a series exploring various aspects of our healthcare system, which even experts will tell you is not a system at all. Our series, The Price We Pay, has examined everything from rising costs to pharmaceuticals to politics and policy. We've explored how where you live can affect your health, and we've looked at the future of medicine. Well, all this week, we are revisiting some of those conversations from the series, and today, we begin by asking a basic question. Why are American outcomes so poor? We're joined by Dana Miller-Irvin, the Holly and Paul Freestone Healthcare Reporting Fellow at WFAE, whose job it is to examine the U.S. healthcare system and to produce this series of reports. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. We're also joined by Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Management at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
Reggie Williams is Vice President of International Health Policy and Practice Innovations with the Commonwealth Fund. That's a foundation promoting better healthcare access and quality, particularly for the disadvantaged. Reggie, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Greetings.
And Christopher Kearns is Vice President of Executive Insights at the Advisory Board, a health research group. Christopher, good morning.
Good morning.
Dana, let me start with a question that you asked me to ask, and it's a darn fine question. We've been talking about the problems associated with American healthcare on this and other programs now literally for decades, particularly when the Affordable Care Act was being discussed. All that's water under the bridge. So why this series now?
It is a perennial issue, but it's an issue that we never seem to solve. Now, right now, the Biden administration is trying to take steps. He's asking more kind of health care legislation be put in this reconciliation bill. But even as we try to expand coverage through Obamacare and other things, we don't seem to solve a lot of the problems. It's something that everybody in the United States, and especially in our audience, needs to know. I mean, I was sort of shocked getting into this. I thought I was extremely well read in this area, and I've been shocked getting into it, how much I've learned.
What are you hoping, and the other folks with you in this endeavor, what are you hoping to accomplish through this series?
Well, this is really an introductory episode. It sort of sets up the entire series. The series is sort of chapters in a book, sort of all of which are digging into the same question, which you just asked at the top of the program, why are we so much sicker given that we spend so much more? And in the first episode, what we look at is how our healthcare delivery system affects our health.
And you said, you told me off the air and you said just a moment ago that as you've gotten into this, you thought you knew things, but you didn't really know them. And you've been stunned by some of the things that you discovered. What surprised you the most?
I came into this thinking we had the best healthcare system in the world, that there were some minor problems. I even was a pre-med. I got into medical school. What I have learned is our problems are so significant that they affect the quality of our care, even for people who think they are fine, even for people with great insurance and means. I interviewed a woman who was a nurse who had great insurance through her hospital. And after she got multiple myeloma, she ended up having to cash out her retirement plans, her pension. She was worried about losing her house.
Reggie, your organization, the Commonwealth Fund, released an updated report comparing U.S. healthcare to that of other countries just a few days ago. Just skim the surface. What did you find?
Thank you. We released a report that looked at the experience of Americans compared to others and 11 different high-income countries. And we evaluated across 71 different measures, looking at topics like access to care, care process, administrative efficiency, equity, healthcare outcomes. And unfortunately, when you do that analysis, the U.S. Came in dead last. And the U.S. came in last because of the performance. Just because people have healthcare insurance in the United States does not mean that they are not vulnerable. The inequality that we have within our system overall really impacts the quality of care people receive or can afford, and ultimately impacts outcomes. When you look at mortality, when you look at being able to access a primary care physician, all those barriers arise because of the fundamental inequalities that we have in care.
Your report tells us that Americans spend an average of $12,641 per person on medical care. Is that per year?
Yes.
And how does that compare to other nations, other Western industrialized nations?
Yeah, it's nearly twice as high. And why we have this situation is because of the price of our health care. When you compare the price of a surgery in the U.S. to a surgery in another country, it's so much higher in the U.S.
And why?
When you look,
why are our prices higher?
Our prices are higher because we don't regulate prices the same. When you look at the other countries that we include in our analysis, there is a system that basically sets prices. They may do it at a national, they may do it at a local level. They may do it for specific services, but they do it in such a way that allows people to get access to service in a way that's ultimately affordable.
So it's that we don't regulate prices. How much of it has to, the fact that we have higher prices have to do with the fact that we are sicker because we don't have proper access in many cases to healthcare? And so when you finally get to see a physician, your healthcare is going to cost you more because you're sicker than you should be.
Well, I think that people are sicker because of some of the fundamental inequities that we have. When you look at income inequity, access to primary care, treating people before they have problems later in life, right, or later as a disease progresses. We don't have a robust system to meet those individuals' needs. And so, yes, many people do end up in our healthcare system and of needing more services, but there's plenty of money in the system. And so we need to think about ways to redirect that towards care earlier on in the process.
Christopher Kearns is with the advisory board, and not only, Christopher, are our costs higher in this country, but people without insurance tend to pay more for their health care, particularly at the hospital. And in hospitals, even though they say they have tried to make pricing more transparent in recent years, it's very difficult to figure out what a procedure is going to cost you. Often you don't know before it's done. And prices can vary wildly between hospitals, even within the same city. Now, the industry says it's trying to fix this. Is it?
Well, it's definitely true that a lot of hospitals and health systems and physician groups are definitely having to deal with the issue of price transparency, right? They're looking at a number of different ways in which they can disclose prices to patients. But the reality is that the vast majority of care isn't paid directly by the patient. The vast majority of care is paid by third parties, whether that is government or whether that is private insurance. And those prices are set through a negotiation process that can vary pretty significantly, even within markets. So as you mentioned, there are significant differences in the prices that are paid for the same procedure at different hospitals within the same market because of different levels of negotiating leverage.
It's Byzantine, because we've done a lot of programs on this, and the way they figured this out is just, it's a labyrinth. Jonathan, Medicare must play a role in all of this because they cover a considerable number of Americans, but we know that they don't regulate drug prices. Does it all boil down to politics?
Everything boils down to politics. But I want to come back to your previous question, which is, in the United States, we have the tendency to view patients as consumers. That's a very American conception. If you think about in France or Germany or Japan, these are people, they're patients. They're not expected to act as rational consumers in the middle of a medical episode. The idea that we can lower costs in our system by having very sick people shop around for medical care is lunacy. You can do it for elective procedures when you have time, but for most medical care procedures, it just doesn't work. And we, one of the many problems we have in American healthcare is we have sort of forced upon our non-system this idea that people should act as consumers. And we put more and more cost in their way and say, go out and act with very little information as consumers. And it's just not possible. Getting back to your question about Medicare, Medicare does a lot and has done a lot for several decades now to regulate prices in terms of what it pays physicians, in terms of what it pays hospitals. There are political limits on what it can do, and there are political limits on what areas it's involved with. And when they passed the legislation in 2003 that brought very late to the game coverage for outpatient prescription drugs to Medicare, the deal that was made was to be hands-off in terms of setting prices. And so Medicare has been hands off, and whether that bargain is gonna last, we'll see.
Reggie, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to hop in on John's point about mm-hmm. the administrative complexity of our healthcare system. We were doing analysis looking at administrative barriers, and the US surprisingly led with the administrative barriers compared to other high income countries. In fact, there were so many barriers for patients and providers that we're the only country that has this job classification of health navigators that are working with patients so they can try to navigate their insurance coverage, what they can pay for, and how it's paid. And now this is even taking off in the digital realm, where we have now a new crop of digital services that are promising to help people navigate healthcare. This simply doesn't happen in other countries. And I think it's a real problem of complexity in our system.
And this is such an essential point Reggie's making, because I know a lot of your listeners like me get explanation of benefit statements. I don't know why they're called that, because it doesn't explain anything in English. You can't understand what they are. And if the United States wants to spend the most money in the world on medical care, I think that's okay if we're actually spending it on medical care and getting a good value. But I think what Reggie is really underscoring, which is fundamental, is that a lot of the money that we spend on medical care in the United States doesn't make anybody any healthier, because it's not on medical care, it's on administrative costs.
But I would have to say that that's a relatively small percentage of the total.
Isn't it about a third? The
actual amount of money that is actually being spent on healthcare, it is coming from really three sources here. It's coming from doctors, the prices that are paid to doctors, it's coming from drugs, and it's coming from devices. For the most part, when we look at the significant differences between healthcare costs from country to country, it really comes down to what are we paying the various professionals, and what are we paying for drug patents? What are we paying for device patents overall? And in the United States, physicians, for example, make roughly twice what they do in many other OECD countries. We have a decided imbalance of specialists versus primary care, which you don't see in other countries, and specialists tend to make even more money. So when you look at how those costs are passed down the system, that creates a downstream problem for a lot of the not-for-profit providers, the hospitals and health systems, that actually have to cover a lot of these costs as well. So you end up with this huge amount of ballooning prices across the board, and that makes the system so much more expensive.
Our conversation about the price of healthcare and why our outcomes are so low compared to the price we pay will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the cost of healthcare and the outcomes that we get, which are not commensurate with the price we pay. And that's the name of the series we're talking about, The Price We Pay, which started this morning on WFAE. Dana Miller-Irvin is the producer of that series. She joins us along with Reggie Williams, Vice President of International Health Policy and Practice Innovations with the Commonwealth Fund. Jonathan Oberlander is a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at UNC Chapel Hill. And Christopher Kearns is Vice President of Executive Insights with the Advisory Board. Reggie, your report, your recent report with the Commonwealth Fund points out that each country has settled on a unique mix of policies, service, delivery systems, and financing models that affect performance, terms to access to care, patient experiences with healthcare, and outcomes. Is it just happenstance that the U.S. finds itself at the bottom of the heap? Did we just make bad choices?
Well, there are definite ways that we can improve upon the way we deliver care. And there are policy opportunities and windows as we think about how we manage coming out of the pandemic and how we invest in infrastructure to do a few things. And there are four that we think are important. One, which is really expanding healthcare insurance. Not everyone in the United States is covered. Some people that have in the United States that have coverage, their coverage is inadequate and doesn't ultimately protect them. And so that's one way that we can help. The second is investing in primary care, having a usual source of care. We've done other research that looks at vaccination. And for people that are vaccine hesitant, having a normal source of primary care, someone they can talk to and engage with, would be a way that they would feel comfortable moving on and ultimately taking the vaccine. Three, administrative burden. Our healthcare system is extraordinarily complex, and that leads to a lot of downstream issues. And then four, is really investing in social services. The fundamental income inequalities that exist in our healthcare system can't fix all the problems. And so when you have individuals that are worried about putting food on the table, a roof over their head, paying for their utilities, childcare, all of those things impact a person's health and their ability to seek health. And so if we were to do those four things, we would look a lot more like other countries.
Dana, this first episode of your series, The Price We Pay, compares American healthcare outcomes with those of other wealthy countries. And the facts that you have uncovered here, in this first episode, are shocking and quite frankly unacceptable. First and foremost, you found that Americans die younger and have more chronic disease than people in other countries. Do you think that most Americans know this?
No, they don't. They don't. And that sort of, they don't know. Nobody realizes any of this stuff, really, honestly. And as I said, it was very much an eye-opener to me. I mean, I think the other point, though, I want to make is we pay a lot of prices we pay a high cost for our healthcare system. And it's not just in terms of some people are sicker, some people are uninsured. I mean, everybody pays. We pay as a patient because we pay premiums and deductibles and so forth, but we pay as taxpayers because Medicare and Medicaid costs go up. Then we pay as an employee because if our employer is contributing to our healthcare premiums and those keep going up, he has less money for other things like salary increases and bonuses and even more jobs. And the last thing is we really pay as a society in a big way because, I interviewed the Nobel Prize winning economist, Angus Deaton, and he says the healthcare system costs so much that it's actually killing jobs, right? Because employers just can't put that $20,000 a year aside. And so people, they don't hire as many people. And that hurts healthcare when people lose jobs.
But the money that somebody has to pay for this care. And in these other countries, whether you want to call it socialized medicine or not, much of it is funded through tax dollars. So when you compare what Americans pay in their copays and premiums and deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses if they don't have insurance versus what people have to pay in taxes in these countries, is it a wash or are they coming out ahead?
No, we pay about double per capita, as a society we pay. And so the other thing I think that is needs to be clarified, because this comes up over and over and over again, is many of these countries we're comparing ourselves, they do not have socialized medicine. This is because socialism is sort of a boogeyman, right? And you talk to people, I talked to many, many people, for example, in Germany. They have insurance companies, just like we do. They don't have socialized medicine, but they don't have all the problems we have.
So let's talk about that for a second, because whenever we want to talk about changing American healthcare, the system of it, even when we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, people were saying, you're not going to take away my right to choose my doctor and when I want to see that person, and I'm not going down the road to socialized medicine. In these countries that have universal healthcare, Christopher, we have heard that there are long wait times to see specialists, and that many people come to the United States to get the care they need when they need a specialist. Are those fears justified?
Partially. You know, there's quite a bit of variance what we see around the world in wait times, for example. So for routine primary care visits, for things that US does not invest nearly enough in primary care, it is much faster to be able to see primary care physicians, for example, or primary care providers in a lot of other countries than it is in the US. At the same time, though, to be able to see a specialist after that primary care visit, that where you are diagnosed with some sort of longitudinal care, cancer, for example, the time to see a specialist in the US does tend to be quite a bit less than what you see in a lot of other countries. And as a result, time to care, especially for some of those critical sorts of conditions, can be quite a bit less here. But that's not universally true, and there's quite a bit of variance.
And in the first episode of this WFAE series, you say that some waiting isn't necessarily a bad thing, and that improving outcomes may involve trade-offs. Explain that.
Well, what I mean by that is there's a great deal of care in this country that is often handed off. So what we see in the US is a system of fragmented care. Fragmentation is, I think, one of the biggest sources of cost overruns in the US. And what we often tend to see is there is some care that can be provided at primary care physicians that is actually pushed into a specialist office. Some things that can be done in a specialist office that are pushed into surgery centers or hospitals, for example. There is not nearly enough what we call top of license care in the US, whereby individual providers can be doing a lot more in the current setting. So when it comes to longitudinal care, caring for the whole patient and making sure there is coordination from primary care all the way to post-acute care, for example, having that coordination and having the ability to have that longitudinal care can sometimes require a little bit of waiting. And that can be a valuable trade-off if we want to be able to care for the whole person over a long period of time.
There are differences, Dana, between the health systems in France and Great Britain and Spain and Norway and places like that, but most of it is tax-supported and most of it is somewhat government-controlled. So why is it not correct to refer to that as socialized medicine?
Well, so socialism is when the government controls the means of production, right? So in Germany, you have some of the foremost engines of the world, capitalistic engines of the world, Germany and so forth, and Japan, and they don't have socialized medicine. What they have is they have multiple insurance providers. You get a policy.
And they've invested in a regulatory framework to manage their system towards the outcomes that they want. If you want affordable care, if you want to ensure that everyone's covered, if you want to manage the price of drugs, you put in policies in place to allow and create that to happen. That's something that we have not fully realized here in the United States, which I think we have more opportunity to do.
But Dana, it's also true, though, that in a lot of those countries, in fact, all of those countries, while it may be true that there is a private healthcare system, there is private insurance, there are public subsidies that go to individuals or go to particular organizations that are designed to offset the cost of that care for individuals. So while it may not be socialism in the way that you're describing it, for sure, there is a great deal of social subsidy that goes in.
But there's social subsidy here.
Yeah, can I add on that? That's right. But, Chris, we subsidize the employer-based system in the United States. We wouldn't call that socialized medicine, but it's heavily subsidized. by the government. You know, the term, so 2 points. One, if you think historically, the term socialized medicine has been used in the United States for a century, and it's been used to refer to everything from private insurance, conventional private insurance when it started, to HMOs when they started way back in the 20th century, to prenatal care for women, to the Medicare program, to the Children's Health Insurance Program. So it's a pejorative term that has no meaning, precise meaning in the United States.
So, Jonathan, go back to something you just said about the government heavily subsidizing our health care. I'm not sure many people understand that or know about it or how it's done. Explain it.
Sure. So we've got, people say we have a private healthcare system in the United States, and it's not been true for a long time. It's a mixed system. And the government, of course, plays a big role and did even before the Affordable Care Act. Over 100 million Americans were getting government health insurance through Medicare, through Medicaid, through the Children's Health Insurance Program. But it turns out the federal government also subsidizes employer-sponsored insurance, which about 160 million Americans, including me, have, basically through the tax system. There are some tax subsidies that add up to hundreds of billions of dollars a year that the government does not collect, and that effectively subsidize private insurance. So people like me who get employer-based coverage and think of it as a exclusively private entity, it's really not. It's really subsidized by the government, and it's just we don't talk about it.
Dana.
Mike, I want to just jump in for a second, because in Germany, they've enacted drug pricing policies specifically so because they were so worried of how the drug prices were affecting their economy, because they were afraid of it affecting their international competitiveness, right? Because they are a free market economy. So they don't want, I mean, I told you this before, before this conversation, but when I started as a Cub reporter back a zillion years ago, healthcare in this country was then 14% of GDP. And I was then doing stories, this was when Clinton was trying to roll out his healthcare reform thing. I was then doing stories about how healthcare had killed US Steel. So because of the high cost of paying healthcare premiums. So it's really, I think it's really a mistake to just classify any kind of regulation or negotiation of prices as socialist.
Jonathan, you've done a lot of studying of the Affordable Care Act before its passage and during its passage and afterward, and although it was accused of being socialized medicine, it is not. But it has brought health insurance to a lot of people who previously didn't have it, and it provides opportunity for that insurance for people who still haven't gotten it but could if they wanted to. But has it had any impact? Has it lowered costs in any way? And has it changed healthcare outcomes in any way?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I feel like I've been talking about the Affordable Care Act for 30 years, which can't be right because it's only been around for a decade, but it's been a really long decade. So the Affordable Care Act, as you mentioned, has been a tremendous success in increasing access to insurance. About 20 million Americans gain coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But even there, its success is limited. There's only one country among the rich democratic world where we could be on a radio show in Charlotte and say, I've got great news. Only 30 million people are uninsured. And that's the United States. I mean, we're the only rich democracy that has a large uninsured population. As we spoke about earlier, we still have this tremendous problem of people being underinsured and being inadequately protected when they do have insurance. And the Affordable Care Act really didn't fix that problem, and in some respects made it worse. In terms of healthcare costs, the Affordable Care Act has done better than was predicted when it was passed in 2010. It's cost a lot less than people thought. The rate of growth in healthcare spending in the United States has continued to go up because it always goes up, but it's gone up at a much more moderate rate over the past decade than it had been prior to the Affordable Care Act's enactment. And it's probably a sort of unheralded success that the law did not accelerate growth in healthcare spending and probably contributed to a moderation of healthcare spending. And one of the reasons it's unheralded is when your base is so high, when you're spending nearly $4 trillion on medical care, the fact that healthcare costs go up only 4% instead of 6% doesn't really feel like much of a victory, but it has made healthcare more affordable for Medicare, for Medicaid, for states, for the federal government, and for employers. And finally, there is still limited evidence because it's fairly new, but there is a growing body of evidence suggesting that the Affordable Care Act has saved lives, and that in states, for example, that expanded Medicaid eligibility to low-income Americans, and North Carolina is not one of them, in those states, they have seen a reduction in mortality.
And the Affordable Care Act, we discover, is liked by most of the people who have insurance through it. So attitudes about it have changed. It's become like Social Security. Don't touch my Obamacare for those who have it. But any kind of change in any realm is going to have resistance. And there was tremendous resistance to this. And there's tremendous resistance to any kinds of changing in how we do business in the healthcare industry, Jonathan. Is it, who's leading the charge? Is it consumers? Is it doctors' groups, hospital groups? Is it pharmaceutical companies? Who's leading the charge in the resistance against moving to something more equitable?
Well, first of all, I think you're quite right that the Affordable Care Act has become more popular over time. And really what helped its popularity is when Republicans tried to repeal it in 2017. That really boosted its numbers. Before that, they were middling. I don't think it's at the levels of Social Security or Medicare. And I frankly don't think it'll ever get there. It's a different kind of program with different kind of constituents and beneficiaries. So it has a different politics. Look, the status quo, we talk about how bad the status quo is in US healthcare. And it is really bad in a lot of respects, but it's also good for a lot of people. The fact that we spend the most money in the world means that a lot of people profit off US healthcare. A dollar spent on medical care is a dollar of income to somebody. So there are lots and lots and lots of parts of the healthcare industry who do well, actually, by the status quo. Meanwhile, there are many consumers who have pretty good insurance, or at least they think they have pretty good insurance. They're not sick very often, and they don't want to change. And so for all these factors, all these different interests we have surrounding the programs, it's hard to move away from the status quo because so many people are benefiting from it.
And all of that adds up to the price we pay, which is what we're talking about, the new WFAE series this morning on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're taking a deep dive, I guess, this morning into the first episode of The Price We Pay, the new WFAE series on the price of healthcare and its comparison to our woeful outcomes. Dana Miller Irvin is the Holly and Paul Freestone Healthcare Reporting Fellow and the producer of that series for us here at WFAE. Reggie Williams is joining us. He's Vice President of International Health Policy and Practice Innovations at Commonwealth Fund. And Jonathan Oberlander, Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Management at UNC Chapel Hill. We're also joined by Christopher Kearns, Vice President of Executive Insights at the Advisory Board. A lot of people have insurance in this country through their employers. This is part of the status quo and the inertia that prevents change because they're happy with it in most cases, even though they're paying higher than ever deductibles in many cases and the copays are rising. Americans also believe that they're covered for most things. But Dana, you report that there are things and they find things that hit them in their lives with medical care. And they suddenly realize, no, we've reached the limit on this policy. How can you tell if your coverage is sufficient?
There's a lot of high deductible health plans out there, and they are a problem. I just interviewed a woman who has multiple sclerosis, and she needed a brand new drug to stop the progression of her disease. And guess what? She's on a high deductible plan, and she's talking about, can she afford her drug or not? Can she take the drug that she needs to prevent really what she refers to as holes in her brain because it's slowing her thinking? I mean, that just shouldn't happen.
I mean, we've talked in the past, particularly in the lead up to Obamacare, about how the cost of healthcare in America is simply unsustainable. That, as you pointed out, the percentage of GDP continues to rise, and at some point, it simply becomes unsustainable. And Germany recognized that, and that's why they've done some of the things that they have done. But when we talk about cost, it doesn't seem to get through to a lot of Americans. It would seem that outcomes, woeful outcomes, which affect grandma and your children, would get through. Americans die younger, you report, than residents in any other wealthy country. They're more likely to die from illnesses that can be treated successfully. And American women are twice as likely to die because of a pregnancy or in childbirth than women in other wealthy countries. Why hasn't that gotten more attention, Dana?
I think it has gotten attention.
Has it moved the needle?
A little bit. So in California, they have managed to reduce maternal mortality by basically having maternal, I'm not sure what they're called, but crash carts. So the doctor, if someone comes in and they're in trouble, the doctor has everything he needs right there to be able to treat it. And they have reduced maternal mortality. I know that Biden, back when he was a candidate, was talking about expanding that. I don't know what's happened to that. I think to some extent, because it is higher in the African-American community than the white community, that might have reduced some attention to it.
Reginald, this is where you come in on this conversation. Yeah. With your expertise. A lot of these chronic health conditions that build up over time and that result in unnecessary deaths or long-term illnesses is due to lack of access to health care. Has the Affordable Care Act improved that in any way? And is the real answer to that problem access to some sort of universal health care where we are all covered?
So the short answer is yes. That is one major step into improving access for people. We have the Affordable Care Act. We have a Medicaid program. We have a Medicare program. We have a robust employer insurance market. Each of those can be expanded in certain ways that would ultimately cover all people. I think one of the things that always comes up when we talk about the U.S. compared to other countries is that we think that the other countries are somehow these monolithic healthcare systems. And it actually took time for many of these countries to evolve. Germany's system that they have today was really kind of a system that built on expanding to different patient populations over time. Or when you looked at the experience of the Netherlands, where they were taking the different forms of insurance in the country and trying to bring them all under one kind of common umbrella as far as the benefits and the way that they were actually paying for services. And then in Canada, it started at a regional level. So you had the individual provinces actually moving the charge towards universal coverage forward before it became a national system. And so we in the U.S. have our own kind of antecedents to the way care is ultimately being delivered and covered, and we can build upon those to achieve universal coverage.
Christopher, we have a for-profit healthcare system in this country, and when you're talking about lowering costs, what immediately comes to mind is the other side of that coin, and that is lower profits. But wouldn't the Walmart principle apply here? If everybody was covered through some sort of universal healthcare coverage, that means more doctor visits, more pharmaceutical prescriptions, etc. Wouldn't the loss of the overprice that we're paying now be made up in volume?
Potentially, but you'd have to actually take down the price of individual care episodes pretty significantly to do so. And that's going to be disruptive, but it doesn't mean that it can't happen, of course. But I should probably correct one thing, though, when you say that we have a for-profit healthcare system. 80% of the hospital beds in this country are not for profit. So when it comes to the most expensive care, which is generally delivered in a hospital setting, 80 something percent of those beds are in fact not for profit.
And do you say they're not for profit because the people in those beds don't have insurance and can't afford to pay?
No, I mean the hospitals and health systems themselves are not for profit organizations.
Okay. When Europeans come to America, they often observe what we eat in restaurants and often comment on the overly large portions that Americans consume. We do have an obesity problem in this country, and that means that a lot of us are making lifestyle choices that are simply unhealthy. How much of the overall cost of medical care in the United States is due to lifestyle choices that consumers are making? I don't know who to ask that question of. Dana, maybe you.
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. I don't know about the cost, but a significant number of our problems are because of obesity. I mean, I want to ask listeners to definitely continue to listen to these series, because some of these topics that you're addressing are covered more in depth, including 2 weeks from now, we're going to be looking at the fact that obesity is an epidemic here, actually, and it's fueling declines in longevity among younger and younger people, actually.
I mean, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, respiratory diseases, all of those things create this cocktail of disease burden that really weighs on our country and our healthcare delivery. But it's all, if you couple that with the insufficient access that we've been talking about, it's just a recipe for disaster. And so I think there's an opportunity to think about, again, investing in primary care, and then also investing in things that make it easier for people to get care, so that you can help a person manage through these chronic conditions. We see it positively happening with many older adults in the United States. And if we could do that with people that are younger before their diseases progress, I think that's an opportunity that would potentially save some costs, but also save lives.
Can I just add one thing? We haven't yet mentioned the opioid epidemic. And if you're looking at why health outcomes in the US are bad, and particularly why they've been bad the last couple decades, you really want to talk about the opioid epidemic, which has taken a terrible toll in this country. And even before COVID, life expectancy in the US was not doing very well. And that largely has to do with the opioid epidemic. And so we unfortunately, it has been getting worse during the pandemic, and we've got the epidemic against the pandemic. We've got to get hold of it if we're going to improve health outcomes in the United States.
Other industrialized nations consider healthcare to be a right. And I remember on this program when we were talking with ordinary people, listeners, about healthcare and whether the Affordable Care Act was the way to go or something like it, I asked the question, is healthcare a right or is it a privilege? I would say that 50% of the people said it's a privilege. How do we move toward changing all the problems that you're uncovering in this series? And I'm not sure who to ask this of either. If that is the prevailing attitude, that it's not a right.
Reggie. I would say that I think that's changing, honestly. I think that's changing. I think that one of the big impacts of the Affordable Care Act was an increasing acceptance of the notion that all people should be given access to healthcare that is affordable to them. It does not mean that we have achieved that yet, for sure, but I do think that that notion is increasingly accepted. And I think this idea of whether or not healthcare is a right or a privilege, I don't know if that's really the right way to think about it. Is healthcare a right or is it a good? Is it something that should be subject to market forces or not? And I think that is the question that we are really not yet resolving.
And I think we also have to think about the fact that, you know, when you don't have a healthy labor force, it's the economy is going to suffer. We know that in states where they've expanded Medicaid, that people end up being able to get jobs who couldn't get jobs before and couldn't hold jobs before. So, and I mean, no employer wants to have workers that are out of work all the time because they're too sick.
Reggie, in these countries where healthcare is viewed as a right, I understand that for-profit healthcare systems are rarely allowed. And if Christopher is correct that 80% of the hospital systems in this country are not for profit, the other 20% are for profit. What impact does that have on the price that we pay?
You know, I will take it back to the concept of regulation. So whether you have a public or private system, if you have the ability to regulate prices in an active way, It allows you to control the overall budget or cost of care. And we just simply don't do that. You can look at Australia, a country where you have some private insurance and some public benefits. And they've instituted a rational pricing system that allows them to have the ability to kind of change and manipulate prices over time in a way that makes the care affordable that's being offered. If we were to make the regulatory commitment to kind of do that, you could see a lot of the change that we've talked about on this call.
If I could bring Chris and Reggie's point, actually try and bring them together, because we don't have that coordinated system of regulation, of price regulation that Reggie is talking about, we wind up in a situation where healthcare spending is determined a lot by competition and by the fact that it's a market good, to Chris's point. And so nonprofits in the US healthcare system behave like for-profits in other countries. In other words, you may have a nonprofit hospital here in the Triangle, and we have a lot of them, but they need customers. They want to expand because they think if they don't expand, they're going to have trouble down the road. And so they're busy buying up practices and busy doing things that you would not see in other countries with universal healthcare. So we sort of are, to Chris's point, halfway in, halfway out. We've never really resolved where we are. And the result is, on the healthcare spending side, we just sort of let it go. And that's how we wound up where we are.
Jonathan, since the Reagan administration, we have been deregulating all kinds of industries, and that includes pricing. So is there any real move to regulate the healthcare industry or the pharmaceutical industry?
Here's maybe a little bit of a historical surprise for some people. The Reagan administration actually advanced price regulation in healthcare. They supported price regulation in healthcare and brought it to Medicare for hospitals with bipartisan support. And it's not like we haven't tried. We've done price regulation in Medicare really since the early 1980s. Lots of states try and regulate Medicaid prices. We use different language. Private employers try and control their prices. We call it bargaining because they can't regulate in quite the same legal way, but they're trying to get the same thing, which is paying less. The problem is, as Beth and Chris and Reggie have rightly mentioned, we have a fragmented payment system. We have a fragmented finance system. So there's no coordination. And because there's no coordination, it just allows costs to go up in different parts of the system that are unregulated. There is more talk these days about, could we have something that's not single payer, not Medicare for all, but maybe could we do what they do in Germany where they have multiple insurers, or do what they do in Japan where they have multiple insurers, and have what's called all payer regulation, and where all payers pay just one price in a given region, which, by the way, would really reduce administrative costs as well. We have a long, long way to go to get there.
Dana, very quickly, what are some of the other areas that you'll be covering as the Price We Pay series continues?
So we'll be talking next week. We'll be talking about social determinants of health, things like access to housing and food and stuff like that. The following week, we'll look at some of the things that we discussed here, obesity and the opioid epidemic, and also suicide. And then after that, we're going to start looking at why our costs are so high, including hospital prices, pharmaceutical prices, administrative costs. That's actually turns out to be a pretty interesting episode. And then we'll look at solutions.
That's WFAE reporter Dana Miller-Irvin. Reggie Williams also joined us, Vice President of International Health Policy and Practice Innovations at the Commonwealth Fund, along with Jonathan Oberlander, Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Management at UNC Chapel Hill. All this week, we will be revisiting many of the shows from our healthcare series, The Price We Pay. Listen for our conversations about how zip codes can determine life expectancy, the high cost of medications, congressional solutions to our healthcare problems, and the future of medicine. You can also catch up on all of Dana's reporting at wfae.org/ThePriceWePay. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.